Welcome, everyone, to Season 4, Episode 7 of Occult Terms and Powers. We're going to keep going through because we are now on letter B, as we just covered letter A. We're going to go through the entire list, of course. It's not to say that everything is going to be covered, because not everything can be covered, but we can at least cover a majority. So that way you all know what we're going to be learning. So we will be able to go through B today on this podcast. We might get into letter C, but we won't finish out C because it is a little bit long. However, be that as it may, we are going to talk about, like I said, banishing. This is the first one that we will cover because it does relate to exorcisms. And exorcisms are witchcraft, okay? There's nothing good about it, okay? Just because they use the name Jesus Christ when they're casting out a demon doesn't mean that they're actually using his power, using our Creator's power to take a demon out of somebody. Now, for those that are Catholic and will say otherwise, keep an open mind. Don't keep living in the program mindset that the satanic bloodlines created, because they did create the Catholic Church. And for anyone to say otherwise is just to deceive themselves. Okay, the Catholic Church was not built by Peter because Jesus told him, I'm going to build this church. I'm going to build the church on this rock. That's not at all what he's talking about. Okay, Yeshua said he's building the church on this rock, meaning he's going to be building it on himself, on the earth. Okay, Peter was not the first pope. He was not a bishop. He was an apostle. There's a difference. So you did not have the Catholic Church until Constantine. Constantine was the first one to create Catholicism. Catholicism never existed beforehand. And I don't care how many Catholics will argue that point, saying, oh, that's just not true, blah, blah, it's not. Yeah, well, Wikipedia will say a bunch of stuff, but does that make it true? No. So. But I can't say otherwise because I am using a list from Wikipedia. But these do at least show some things. So I'm not going to say like, hey, I'm going to tell you everything here that's on this list from Wikipedia is all correct. No. No. I'll just go based upon what I've researched and what I know to date. So that way I can help you all. But banishing is one or more rituals intended to remove spiritual beings, i.e. exorcism for Christianity, Catholicism, right? That's the basic of it. Now, even when you go into it, all right, it's not a very long list, but it actually talks about part of a... So, with a lot of these things, it'll say part of a series on such and such. Well, banishing is part of a series on Thelema. And in here, as it says, in ceremonial magic, banishing refers to one or more rituals intended to remove non-physical influences ranging from spirits to negative influences. Although banishing rituals are often used as components of more complex ceremonies, they can also be performed by themselves. Banishing can be viewed as one of several techniques of magic, closely related to ritual purification and a typical prerequisite for consecration and invocation. Invocation. In the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram must be learned by the neophyte before moving on to the next grade, Zelator. For actual workings, Aleister Crowley recommends a short general banishing with a comment that, quote, in more elaborate ceremonies, it's usual to banish everything by name. Crowley also recommended that a banishing ritual be done at least once daily by Thelemites in Liber Aleph Val CXI. In Wicca, various forms of neopaganism, banishing is performed before casting a magic circle in order to purify the area where the ritual or magic is about to take place. In his book Nocturnal Witchcraft, for example, Constantinos recommends performing banishing regularly in order to keep the magical workspace free of negativity and to become proficient in banishing before attempting acts that are much more spiritually taxing on the body, such as magical spell working. And the only other thing that they have here is rituals such as the Lesser Ritual of the Pentagram, Greater Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram, Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Hexagram, Greater Banishing Ritual of the Hexagram, and the Star Ruby, a version of the Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram that was modified by Aleister Crowley for the use of adherence to Thelema. So, as you can see, the hexagram is not a good thing. It is an occult tool that is used to bring in demons and evil spirits. Now, granted, it didn't talk about anything of a Catholic nature in here, or Christianity. When we go to exorcism, it actually references to the fact of banishing. Oh yeah. So, we're going to go over that, and not on this episode, but when we get to letter E, we will. So, now that I have y'all here, and what we're going to cover, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and get right into the rest of the stuff. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back, everyone. Appreciate you all staying tuned into this awesome content. Well, the next one I have on the list says Biblomancy. We're going to go to the next one, which is actually Banshee. So Banshee in here is Irish, and it means woman of the fairy mound or fairy woman. But a banshee is a female spirit in Irish folklore who heralds the death of a family member, usually by screaming, wailing, shrieking, or keening. If you don't know what keening is, it's a traditional form of vocal lament for the dead in the Gaelic Celtic tradition, known to have taken place in Ireland and Scotland. Her name is connected to the mythologically important tumuli, or mounds, that dot the Irish countryside, which are known as Side, singular is Sid, in Old Irish. Apparently, the description, sometimes she has long, streaming hair and wears a gray cloak over a green dress, and her eyes are red from continual weeping. She may be dressed in white with red hair and a ghastly complexion, according to a first-hand account by Anne, Lady Fanshawe in her memoirs, Lady Wild in her books, provides others. Origin is said to that most, though not all, surnames associated with banshees have, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it looks like an O with a thingy over it, like a little slash, or Mick or slash Mac prefix. Oh, I think that's what I mean, like O'Brien, O'Conan, or O'Brien. I think that's what they're meaning. It has surnames of Goidelic origin, indicating a family native to the insular Celtic lands rather than those of the Norse, Anglo-Saxon, or Norman. Accounts reach as far back as 1380 to the publication of the Catherine Thordhailbaig. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's called Triumphs of Torlough by Sean Mac Craith. Mentions of banshees can also be found in Norman literature of that time. The Ua Brian or Brienne Banshee is thought to be named Ibel, and the ruler of 25 other banshees who would always be at her attendance. It's possible that this particular story is the source of the idea that the wailing of numerous banshees signifies the death of a great person. In some parts of Leinster, she is referred to as the Bean Coyote, Keening Woman, whose wail can be so piercing that it shatters glass. In Scottish folklore, a similar creature is known as the Bean Nye, or Bon Nye Cain, little washerwoman. I'm not even going to pronounce the next one, but it would be called Little Washer at the Ford, and is seen washing the blood-stained clothes of armor of those who are about to die. In Welsh folklore, a similar creature is known as the Cyhyraeth. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's a ghostly spirit in Welsh mythology. So, that's what Banshee is. Baphomet is the next one on the list that we have here. Many of you have heard of Baphomet, but Baphomet is not Satan, okay? Baphomet is an evil being, but he's not Satan, okay? The one that people think that is Satan, or really associate, is the cherubim that was over the king of Tyre. It's talked about in, I believe, in Isaiah. I'm not mistaken, or Ezekiel. I believe it's Isaiah. But Baphomet has the head of a goat, body of a woman, I believe. Because Baphomet, to me, Baphomet looks like he got boobs. But then has a lower half of like goat. But essentially, this is what it says. Baphomet is a deity allegedly worshipped by the Knights Templar that subsequently became incorporated into various occult and Western esoteric traditions. And yeah, they actually talk about this in Assassin's Creed Unity. How there were Knights Templar worshipping Baphomet. Very briefly did they nudge that in there. The name Baphomet appeared in trial transcripts for the Inquisition of the Knights Templar starting in 1307. It first came into popular English usage in the 19th century during debate and speculation on the reasons for the suppression of the Templar order. Baphomet is a symbol of balance in various occult and mystical traditions, the origin of which some occultists have attempted to link with the Gnostics and Templars, although occasionally purported to be a deity or demon. Since 1856, the name Baphomet has been associated with the Sabbatic goat image drawn by Eliphas Levi. Composed of binary elements representing the symbolization of the equilibrium of opposites, half human and half animal, male and female, good and evil, etc. Levi's intention was to symbolize his concept of balance, with Baphomet representing the goal of perfect social order. Yeah, so, that the drawing by Eliphas Levi might have some truth to it, but I haven't dealt with Baphomet face-to-face in the spirit. However, a history relating to this, the name Baphomet appeared in July 1098 in a letter about the siege of Antioch by the French crusader Anselm of Ribamont. Has a Latin translation as well as English. So the English says, as the next day dawned, they, i.e. the inhabitants of Antioch, called loudly upon Baphomet, and we prayed silently in our hearts to God. Then we attacked and forced all of them outside the city walls. Weird how they have capital letter G for God, and that's not true. Lowercase G. But coming into historical aspects does have a lot to convey upon it, such as one picture here, which has a pentagram. You have the Hebraic letters. So you have the pentagram right side up, Okay, it looks like a star. You have the name Adam, and there's a picture of a man, and then on the top and then on the bottom, Eve. And then you have the Hebraic letters, five of them, at the 5 points of the star. And then under that, you have the one with the goat's head, the upside down pentagram. Then you have the top one saying Semael, and the underside saying Lilith, as well as the same Hebraic letters at the points of the star. Drawings of upright and inverted pentagrams representing spirit over matter, holiness, and matter over spirit, evil, respectively, from La Clef de la Magie Noire, 1897, by French cultist Stanislas de Guaita. And it says, note the names Adam, Eve, Samael, and Lilith. We already talked about the different types of demons, Samael as one of the demons. But in here, there is alternate etymologies. You talk about Joseph Freier von Hammer, hyphen Pergstall, was born 1774, died 1856, is associated a series of carved or engraved figures found on a number of supposed 13th century Templar artifacts, such as cups, bowls, and coffers of the Baphometic idol. You also have Oliphas Levi, talks about it, Witch's Sabbath, it's mentioned in it. Socialism, Romanticism, and Magnetism, that talks a bit about this. For example, in Socialism, Romanticism, Magnetism, Levi's references to the School of Alexandria and the Templars can be explained against the background of debates about the origins and character of true Christianity. It has been pointed out that these debates included contemporary forms of romantic socialism or utopian socialism, which were seen as the heirs of the Gnostics, Templars, and other mystics. Levi, being himself an adherent of these schools since the 1840s, regarded the socialists and romantics, such as Alphonse de Lamartine, as the successors of this alleged tradition and true religion. In fact, his narrative mirrors historiographies, forgive me for butchering that name, of socialism, including the Histoire des Montagnards, 1847, by his best friend and political comrade, Alphonse Esquiros. Consequently, the Baphomet is depicted by Levi as a symbol of a revolutionary heretical tradition that would soon lead to the emancipation of humanity and the establishment of a perfect social order. In Levi's writings, the Baphomet does not only express a historical political tradition, but also occult natural forces that are explained by his magical theory of the astral light. He developed this notion in the context of what has been called spiritualist magnetism, theories that stress the religious implications of magnetism, and we're going to talk about that later. Often their representatives were socialists that believed in the social consequences of a synthesis or of religion and science that was to be achieved by the means of magnetism. Spiritualist magnetists with socialist background include the Baron du Potet and Henri Delage, who served as main sources for Levi. At the same time, Levi polemicized against famed Catholic authors such as Jules Eudes de Mirville and Roger Guguenot des Museaux, who regarded magnetism as the workings of demons and other infernal powers. Yeah. Levi polemicized against famed Catholic authors, the two that I mentioned, who regarded magnetism as the workings of demons and other infernal powers. The paragraph just before the passage cited in the previous section has to be seen against this background. Quote, "Let us state now for the edification of the vulgar, for the satisfaction of M., Le Comte de Merville, for the justification of the demonologist Bodin, for the greater glory of the Church, which persecuted Templars, burnt magicians, excommunicated Freemasons, etc., Let us state boldly and precisely that all the inferior initiates of the occult sciences and profaners of the great arcanum not only did in the past, but do now and will ever adore what is signified by this alarming symbol. And of course, it does talk about more things such as Godev Mendez, Aleister Crowley, modern interpretation and usage. In here. So, I want you all to know that even though the Satanic Temple or the Church of Satan has Baphomet as a character, they don't worship Satan because it's not a true Satanist church. They just believe in being a god themselves, even though they can't manifest anything spiritually. Into the physical. But true Satanists are pedophiles and do blood rituals. Okay. Now, moving on to Beltane. Or you can pronounce it Beltane. So, this one, I believe I have an idea from this because I did not write this one down. Okay. So, Beltane or Beltane is the Gaelic May Day festival. It's traditionally held on May 1st, or about midday between the spring equinox and summer solstice in the Northern Hemisphere. The festival name is synonymous with the mouth marking the start of summer in Gaelic Ireland. Historically, it was widely observed throughout Ireland, Scotland, and the Isle of Man. In Irish, the name for the festival day as La Beltane, while the month of May is Mi na Beltane. In Scottish Gaelic, Latha Beltane, spelled a little bit differently, and in Manx Gaelic, La Boltini Bolden. Beltane is one of the four main Gaelic seasonal festivals, along with Samhain, Imbolc, and Lugnasad. Then is similar to the Welsh Calan Mai. Beltane is mentioned in the earliest Irish literature and is associated with important events in Irish mythology, also known as Ketchamain. First of summer is what it means. It marks the beginning of summer and was when cattle were driven out to the summer pastures. Rituals were performed to protect cattle, people, and crops, and to encourage growth. Special bonfires were kindled, whose flames, smoke, and ashes were deemed to have protective powers. The people and their cattle would walk around or between bonfires and sometimes sleep over the flames and embers. All household fires would be doused and then relit from the Beltane bonfire. These gatherings would be accompanied by a feast, and some of the food and drink would be offered to the Ausi. It's an Irish name for a supernatural race in Celtic mythology. Doors, windows, byres, and livestock would be decorated with yellow mayflowers, perhaps because they evoked fire. In parts of Ireland, people would make a may bush, typically a thorn bush or branch decorated with flowers, ribbons, bright shells, and rushlights. Holy wells were also visited, while Beltane dew was thought to bring beauty and maintain youthfulness. Many of these customs were part of May Day or Midsummer festivals in parts of Great Britain and Europe. Public celebrations of Beltane fell out of popularity by the 20th century, though some customs continue to be revived as local cultural events. Since the late 20th century, Celtic neo-pagans and Wiccans have observed a festival based on Beltane as a religious holiday. And it does talk about the name, its etymology, toponymy, historic customs, such as Beltane was one of four Gaelic seasonal festivals, Samhain, November 1st, Imbolc, February 1st, Beltane, May 1st, and Lugnasad, August 1st. Beltane marked the beginning of the pastoral summer season, when livestock were driven out to the summer pastures. Rituals were held at that time to protect them from harm, both natural and supernatural, and this mainly involved the symbolic use of fire. There were also rituals to protect crops, dairy products, and people, and to encourage growth. The Aos Sea, often referred to as spirits of fairies, were thought to be especially active at Beltane. And the goal of many Beltane rituals was to appease them. Most scholars see the Aos Sea as remnants of the pagan gods and nature spirits. Beltane was a spirit time festival of optimism, during which fertility ritual again was important, perhaps connecting with the waxing power of the sun. Ancient and medieval talks about the modern era, bonfires, flowers and may bushes, appeasing the fairies, Beltane blessings, other customs. One of the customs is also, they actually show it in Assassin's Creed Valhalla, of a yearly bonfire done where it looks like a man, and then the leader would go into this effigy of this wood, this man put together of just sticks put together to make it look like a man effigy, and then they would burn the effigy on fire with that leader in it. Yeah, it's messed up. I was like, this is just stupid. Why they have these things? That's just how the enemy confuses people. But there's revival, neo-paganism, Celtic reconstructionist, and it also talks about Wicca. Next, we're going to talk about Benedicaria, Italian meaning, which means way of blessing. It's a relatively new term for a number of loosely related family-based folk traditions found throughout Italy, most notably in southern Italy and Sicily. Though referred to by some as folk magic or even as witchcraft, the various Benedicaria traditions are concerned almost exclusively with healing, cleansing, spirituality, and religious devotion. Benedicaria is also known as Benedicazoin, I believe that's how you pronounce it, which means blessing, in a Catholicese dialect. Benedica means blessed in Catanian, and Falu Santuccio, literally meaning do a little holy thing in Campania. Unlike practitioners of Stregeria and some practitioners of Stregoneria, practitioners of Benedicaria consider themselves to be devout Catholics, and the practices of Benedicaria are inextricably linked with Italian popular devotions found in traditional Catholicism. So, put it this way, because there's a couple other things here and there, like relationship with Stregeria and Stregoneria. If the power source does not come from God, they are, in fact, doing witchcraft. So, for example, there is much discussion on the subject of what exactly is entailed by the terms Benedicaria, Stregoneria, and Stregeria. However, the one thing upon which all parties agree is that these three things are all different from one another. In 2005, a poster on Mystic Wix asked Raven Grimassi his opinion concerning Benedicaria, and Grimassi responded that he had read Quattrocchi's book, that it seemed authentic in the material it covered, and that it neither has nor claims any relationship with Italian witchcraft. In response to this, Quattrocchi expressed his thanks that all sides of the debate acknowledged Stregeria and Benedicaria as two entirely separate and unrelated practices. The relationship between Stregoneria and Benedicaria is more confounded entirely, since in their purest forms the two are completely distinct. However, most practitioners make use of elements from both traditions, and many practitioners were raised with or taught elements of both traditions, so much so that over the course of centuries, it's become impossible to tell where one ends and the other begins. In many cases, even the practitioner herself is not certain as to the distinctions. So as we see more, this is witchcraft, okay? You have to discern what it is that you're doing. So, because when it says in many cases, even the practitioner herself is not certain as to the distinctions. If you can't know the distinction between what you're doing, you're involved in witchcraft. That's just the bottom line to it. So for them to say like, oh, it has nothing to do with witchcraft, but you can't discern the distinction between the of what you're doing, you're involved in witchcraft. Because when you're using the power from God to restore creation, you know exactly the distinction between whether you're prophesying, whether you're healing, whether you're laying your hands, whatever, okay? The confusion between the two practices became an object of contention between Rue Rosselli and Vito Quattrocci in May 2007, when Quattrocci posted two videos on YouTube featuring an interview between himself and a sympathetic priest regarding the subject. In these videos, the priest, a mutual friend of both Rosselli and Quattrocci, stressed the fact that Benedicaria is not witchcraft, that it is entirely separate from witchcraft, and that the practitioner of Benedicaria is generally a devout Catholic who makes no pretensions of being a witch. Rosselli cited the tendency of Benedetti to blend the two practices, which was not mentioned in the videos. The videos have since been removed from YouTube, but this debate comes to show that the relationship between Benedicaria and Stregoneria is one of the synthesis and convolution. So, not something to get involved in. As you can see, there is heavy witchcraft in the church, specifically what we've talked about so far in Catholicism. Next, bibliomancy. All right. This is what I did talk about in the first episode of the list that we were going through. It's the use of books in divination. It's a method of employing sacred books, especially specific words and verses, for magical medicine, removing negative entities, or for divination, consulting information on the internet, maybe. Ties to religions, including Christianity. So, bibliomancy is the use of books in divination, like I said. And according to the Oxford English Dictionary, the word bibliomancy, etymologically, from biblion, book, and mantia, divination by means of, quote, in quotations, divination by books or by verses of the Bible, was first recorded in 1753 under Chambers' Cyclopedia. Sometimes this term is used synonymously with stichomancy. Quote, divination by lines of verse in books taken at hazard, end quote, which was first recorded circa 1693, Urquhart's Rabelais. Bibliomancy compares with rhapsodomancy, from rhapsody, poem, song, ode, divination by reading a random passage from a poem. A historical precedent was the ancient Roman practice of sorts, sortilege, divination by drawing lots, which specialized in two sorts, homericae, sorts virgilinae, and sorts sanctorum, using the texts of Homer, Virgil, and the Bible. So, by casting lots, is what people would be doing when they are looking for specific verses for their future. History says in Judaism, according to the Shulchan Aruch, which is from Rima, Yore Dea 179, it's not the sin of necromancy to divine an answer by asking a child for the first piece of scripture that comes to his mind. So that's different, you know, memorizing words and sentences is very much different. It has nothing to do with bibliomancy. So here's a method that they talk about. Number one, a book is picked that is believed to hold truth. Two, it is balanced on its spine and allowed to fall open. Three, a passage is picked with the eyes closed. And this is what it talks about. Among Christians, the Bible is most commonly used in the Sortes Sanctorum, and in Islamic cultures, the Quran. In the Middle Ages, the use of Virgil's Aeneid was common in Europe and known as the Sortes Virgilinae. In the classical world, the Sortes Virgilinae and Sortes Homericae, using the Iliad and Odyssey, were used. In Iran, bibliomancy using the Divan of Hafez is the most popular for this kind of divination, but by no means the only kind. The Quran, as well as Mathnawi of Rumi, may also be used. Forgive me if I butcher some of these names again. Fal-i-Hafez may be used for one or more people. In group bibliomancy, the Divan will be opened at random and beginning with the ode of the page that one chances upon. Each ode will be read in the name of one of the individuals in the group. The ode is the individual's fal, which is F-A-L, the line over the A. Assigning of the odes to individuals depends on the order in which the individuals are seated and is never random. One of three verses from the ode following each individual's fal is called the sahed, which is read after the recitation of the fal. According to another tradition, the Sahed is the first of the seventh verse from the ode following the fall. An ode which had already been used for one individual in the group is disqualified from serving as the fall for a second time. Because book owners frequently have favorite passages that the books open themselves to, some practitioners use dice or another randomizer to choose the page to be opened. This practice was formalized by the use of coins or yarrow stocks in consulting the I Ching. Tarot divination can also be considered a form of bibliomancy, with the main difference that the cards, pages, are unbound. Another way this is to cut the page with something like a razor. There is a prevalent practice among certain, particularly messianic, members of Chabad Lubavitch Hasidic movement to use the Igrat Kodesh, a 30-volume collection of letters written by their leaders, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, for guidance. If you don't know what Chabad is, it's also known as Lubavitch Chabad and Chabad Lubavitch. It's an Orthodox Jewish Hasidic dynasty. Another variant requires the selection of a random book from a library before selecting the random passage from that book. This also holds if a book has fallen down from a shelf on its own. English poet Robert Browning used this method to ask about the fate of his attraction to Elizabeth Barrett, later known as Elizabeth Barrett Browning. He was at first disappointed to choose the book, Cerutti's Italian Grammar, but on randomly opening it, his eyes fell on the following sentence. If we love in the other world as we do in this, I shall love thee to eternity. Which was a translation exercise. So, as you can see, bibliomancy, not to be involved with. That's why, like, for example, with the Bible, you have the Holy Spirit guide you. Biosophy. This is the next one that we spoke of. It's a, in a way, a sect of mystery and order, because it's an ideology of removing the old system of thinking to be opened up to the to New World Order Son of Perdition plan. Is it specifically that's what Biosophy is? No, it has connotation towards it. For example, meaning wisdom of life is, quote, the science and art of intelligent living based on the awareness and practices of spiritual values, ethical social principles, and character qualities essential to individual freedom and social harmony. End quote. It stands in relation to biology, which can be broadly described as the understanding of life. And in here, there is a history of it. There is a biosophy program as well. And objectives. Okay? So the history is the term biosophy was probably first used in 1806 by Ignaz Paul Vitalis Truxer, a Swiss philosopher whose early works followed F.W.J. Schelling. It was later used by other philosophers like Peter Wessel Zapf, who was born 1899, died 1990, who used biology as the foundation of his philosophy. Zapf first set out his ideas in Den Sitz Messias, meaning the last Messiah, 1933. Later, Zapf gave a more systematic defense in his philosophical treaty. I do not know how to pronounce that, but it means On the Tragic, which came out in 1941. The Biosophical Institute claims that Frederick Kettner, born 1886, died 1957, was the founder of Biosophy. Kettner was himself originally inspired by the organicism of Konstantin Brunner. Contemporary biosophers include Jung, I believe it's pronounced Jung Bach, who defines biosophy as a, quote, new way of performing philosophy generated from scientific and biological awareness, end quote. Bach, which is spelled B-H-A-K, developed his theory of biosophy while studying at Cambridge University in 1995 and afterwards. The main difference of Bach's biosophy from other philosophy is that his biosophy is a computable philosophy. It borrows Bertrand Russell, logicism, and extends it to a computational set of ideas and knowledge. One ultimate aim of biosophy is to construct a logical thinking machine that can do philosophy for human beings. So the biosophy program was presented on the internet by Anna Oman and Svenlov Lindgren in January 1998. They noted that the term biosophy was previously used by Zapf in a literary context for the analysis of human social life based on philosophy of existence and biological facts. Such a narrow circumscription of biosophy, in our opinion, no obstacle to widen the definition to encompass all systematic thinking on biological issues. The biosophy program was intended to circumscribe and synthesize biological studies in a philosophical framework to support teaching at courses on philosophy and courses on biology. The biosophical thinking is defined by Oman and Lindgren in five philosophical fields and discriminated from Nace's ecosophy. Here are their objectives. To create biosophical grips for character and peace education where the individual has opportunities of self-improvement. To encourage integration among individuals based on their mutual interest in a spiritual purpose in life. Sounds harmless thus far, right? You know? To network with other groups and organizations interested in character and peace education, working cooperatively with them. To replace the blind acceptance of theological beliefs, superstitions, and dogmas with the cultivation of spiritual intelligence as the basis for the religion of freedom and friendship. to create a world fellowship of peace-loving human beings who have overcome religious, national, racial, and social prejudices, who can work creatively for the growth of democracy, spiritual personal growth, and world peace. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's one of the objectives, to create a world fellowship of peace, loving human beings who have overcome religious, national, racial, and social prejudices, who can work creatively for the growth of democracy, spiritual personal growth, and world peace. To work for the synthesis of religion, philosophy, science, education, and art. To perpetuate and advance Kettner's principles and work for the development and cultivation of the character and peace nature in young people. To create a peace department in national governments headed by a Secretary of Peace, and to establish peace universities. To establish a world fellowship of thinking human beings who can work creatively for the growth of spiritual democracy and world peace. To cooperate in the advancement of humanity from civilization to the age of, in quotations, soulization. So now you can see why I have put it down as ideology of removing the old system of thinking to be opened up to the New World Order Center of Perdition plan. There will never, ever, ever be world peace. As long as the satanic bloodlines are around, as long as death exists, as long as there's demons, evil spirits, and so forth, as long as people want to be greedy, as long as people want to hurt, and so forth, there will not be world peace. So, be that as it may, we can still work towards it, towards manifesting the kingdom of God. Because we're to subdue the enemy. But with that being said, everyone, it's been real. And I appreciate you all listening into this awesome content, but we're going to take a brief pause and then come. And what we're going to cover here next is biorhythm, which is a type of pseudoscience. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back, everyone. Now, let's cover biorhythm, what that talks about, really. This is biorhythm. It says it's a pseudoscience, and there is a calculation that talks about for physical, emotional, intellectual. And it talks about history and critical views of it, as well as additional studies by two different individuals. But what is biorhythm? Biorhythm says is a pseudoscientific idea that people's daily lives are significantly affected by rhythmic cycles with periods of exactly 23, 28, and 33 days. Typically, a 23-day physical cycle, a 28-day emotional cycle, and a 33-day intellectual cycle. The idea was developed by Wilhelm Flies, with two S's, in the late 19th century, and was popularized in the United States in the late 1970s. The proposal has been independently tested, and consistently no validity for it has been found. According to the theory of biorhythms, a person's life is influenced by rhythmic, biological cycles that affect his or her ability in various domains, such as mental, physical, and emotional activity, minus spiritual. These cycles begin at birth and oscillate in a steady, they say sine wave, which is S-I-N-E, in a steady fashion throughout life, and by modeling them mathematically, it suggested that a individual's level of ability in each of these domains can be predicted from day to day. The theory is built on the idea that the biofeedback chemical and hormonal secretion functions within the body could show a sinusoidal behavior over time. Sinusoidal.
Soil.
Yeah. Most biorhythm models use three cycles, 23-day physical cycle, 28-day emotional cycle, and 33-day intellectual cycle. Although the 28-day cycle is the same length as the average woman's menstrual cycle and was originally described as a female cycle, the two are not necessarily in synchronization. Each of these cycles varies between high and low extremes sinusoidally. I believe that's how you pronounce it, with days where the cycle crosses the zero line described as critical days of greater risk of uncertainty. The numbers from plus 100% maximum to minus 100% minimum indicate where on each cycle the rhythms are on a particular day. In general, a rhythm at 0% is crossing the midpoint and is thought to have no real impact on one's life. Whereas a rhythm at plus 100% at the peak of that cycle would give one an edge in that area. And a rhythm at minus 100% at the bottom of that cycle would make life more difficult in that area. There is no particular meaning to a day on which one's rhythms are all high or all low, except the obvious benefits of hindrances that these rare extremes are thought to have on one's life. In addition to the three popular cycles, various other cycles have been proposed based on linear combination of the three, or on longer or shorter rhythms. Now, it talks about the basic rhythm details. The physical cycle is coordination, strength, well-being. Emotional cycle is creativity, sensitivity, mood, perception, and awareness. While the intellectual cycle is alertness, analytical functioning, logical analysis, memory or recall, communication. Now, does this work, and would it be useful? Based upon the technology that the enemy is using, it would not be exactly useful. Nope. But let's say that the enemy wasn't using this technology against us. Maybe there is that possibility. However, that being said, it doesn't seem to be anything revolving towards a cult. It's just checking out the physical, emotional, and intellectual side of things, how things are operating. So I believe this would be something essential that would help people. Right now, not so much. Because we need to get rid of a lot of the things the enemy has placed, at least physically, to be removed before we can start getting back on track. So, next. Black magic. Okay. I put it down as involving death and trauma, which is correct. All right. So, black magic. You have here another word for it is called nigromancy. Yes, that's another name for it. It's not racist. It's just spelled N-I-G-R-O-M-A-N-C-Y. It means black magic, together with six associated practices of black divination, as traditionally referred to you to the use of supernatural powers of magic for evil and selfish purposes. Specifically, the seven magical arts prohibited by canon law, as expounded by Johannes Hartlib in 1456. In 1597, King James the VI and I published a treatise, Daemonology, a philosophical dissertation describing contemporary nigromancy and the historical relationship between the various methods of divination used in black magic. This book is believed to be one of the main sources used by William Shakespeare in the production of Macbeth. The links and interaction between black magic and religion are many and varied, beyond black magic's historical persecution by Christianity and its inquisitions. There are links between religious and black magic rituals. For example, 17th century priest Etienne Guibourg is said to have performed a series of black mass rituals and alleged with alleged witch Catherine Monvoisin for Madame de Montespan. During his period of scholarship, A.E. Waite provided a comprehensive account of black magic practices, rituals, and traditions in The Book of Ceremonial Magic, came out in 1911. The influence of popular culture has allowed other practices to be drawn in under the broad banner of black magic, including the concept of Satanism. While the invocation of demons or spirits is an accepted part of black magic, this practice is distinct from the worship of deification of such spiritual beings. The two are usually combined in medieval beliefs and about witchcraft. And then it goes into the history of it, of course. The history, not exactly going back thousands of years. But it does talk about how in common use from 1200 to approximately 1500 AD, that is. And there is the seven artes prohibita, or arts magica, prohibited by canon laws expanded by Johannes Hartlib, 1456. Talks about nigromancy as one of them, which is black magic. The others, as well, I'm going to mention just in a moment, but they are all what you would call Renaissance magic. Number two, you have geomancy. Number three, hydromancy. Four, aromancy. Five, pyromancy. Six, chiromancy. Seven, scapulomancy. These aren't the only ones, but these are some of them. We will talk about them. I'll go over them briefly here, because we will talk about them later. But geomancy is the art of when one of the more popular forms of divination practiced during the Renaissance, form of divination in which any question may be answered by casting sand, stone, or dirt on the ground and reading the shapes using tables of geomantic figures for interpretation. Hydromancy is a divination form of divination using water. Then you have aromancy, divination consisted in tossing sand, dirt, or seeds into the air and studying the interpretation of the patterns of the dust cloud or the settling of the seeds, because it's talking about, you know, air. This also includes divination coming from thunder, comets, falling stars, and the shape of clouds. Pyromancy is the art of divination which consists of signs, patterns from flames. Chiromancy is a form of divination based on reading palms and based on intuitions and symbolism, with some symbols tying into astrology, and scapulomancy, form of divination using an animal's scapula. Yeah, scapula would be broken, and based on how it was broken, it could be used to read the future. It was generally broken by heating it with hot coals until it broke. Yeah, so, messed up stuff. But the next one that we have is called Black Mass. So, Black Mass. It is a ceremony typically said to be celebrated by various satanic groups. It has allegedly existed for centuries in different forms and is directly based on and is intentionally a sacrilegious and blasphemous mockery of a Catholic Mass. In the 19th century, the Black Mass became popularized in French literature in books such as Satanism and Witchcraft by Jules Michelet and Labas by Joris Carl Huysmans. Modern revivals began with H.T.F. Rhodes' book The Satanic Mass, published in London in 1954. And there's now a range of modern versions of the Black Mass performed by various groups. So the Black Mass stuff that happens today in the public, just not really true Black Mass. But you have in here history, early Catholicism. The Catholic Church regards the Mass as its most important ritual going back to apostolic times. In general, its various Liturgies followed the outline of the liturgy of the word, offertory liturgy of the Eucharist and benediction, which developed into what is known as the Mass. However, as early Christianity became more established and its influence began to spread, the early church fathers began to describe a few heretical groups practicing their own versions of Masses. Some of these rituals were of a sexual nature. The 4th century AD heresiologist Epiphanius of Salamis, for instance, claims that a libertine Gnostic sect known as the Borborites, I believe that's how you pronounce it, Borborites, engaged in a version of the Eucharist in which they would smear their hands with menstrual blood and semen and consume them as the blood and body of Christ, respectively. He also alleges that whenever one of the women in their church was experiencing her period, they would take her menstrual blood and everyone in the church would eat it as part of a sacred ritual. Which I'm sure they would do. But what we have here as well is medieval Roman Catholic parodies and additions to the Mass, as well as early modern France talked about it. Late 19th and early 20th century scholarly interest in the Black Mass, 20th century, 21st century, the modern Black Mass, the language of Black Mass, that talks about it in there. So, is that to say that there isn't actually Black Mass that does happen that is very evil? No, I'm sure it does happen, but the vast majority out there, just to put on a show. Now, the next one, this one, is for all you Nazi lovers out there. This one is called Black Sun Symbol. Well, the Black Sun, which is a symbol. Alright, so, if you actually look at the stormtroopers in Star Wars, they have a roughly similar image. It's a black circle in the center, and then there's like a circle, a white circle line around it, but it's dotted, and then another black circle line around that, and then you have these lines, about 12 of them in a circle, that then before it hits the outer black circle set it moves to the right and then goes straight up. That's the best way I can describe it. The black sun is a type of sun wheel, symbol originating in Nazi Germany and later employed by neo-Nazis and other far-right individuals and groups. The symbol's design consists of 12 radial sig runes, similar to the symbols employed by the SS in their logo. It first appeared in Nazi Germany as a design element in a castle at Wewelsburg, remodeled and expanded by the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, which he intended to be the center for the SS. It's unknown whether the design had a name or held any particular significance among the SS. Its association with the occult originates with a 1991 German novel, Die Schwarze Sonne von Tashi Lunpo, The Black Sun of Tashi Lunpo, by the pseudonymous author Russell MacLeod. The book links the Wewelsburg mosaic with the neo-Nazi concept of the Black Sun, invented by former SS officer Wilhelm Landig as a substitute for the Nazi swastika. The Anti-Defamation League notes that though the symbol is popular with white supremacists, imagery resembling the Black Sun features in many cultures, and that such imagery should always be analyzed in the context in which it appears, as it may not necessarily be intended to serve as a symbol of white supremacy or racism. Yeah, Yeah, the ADL literally says that. How very interesting when they say anti-Semitic. You're against Jewish people. But we do talk about, well, it does talk about Wewelsburg Mosaic and the Nazi period, neo-Nazism, and other uses. So, moving on to the next one is called Blarney Stone. The Blarney Stone is a block of carboniferous limestone built into the battlements of Blarney Castle, Blarney. About 6 kilometers, excuse me, 8 kilometers, just 5 miles from Cork Island, or Cork, Ireland. According to legend, kissing the stone endows the kisser with the gift of the gob, great elegance or skill at flattery. The stone was set into a tower of the castle in 1446. The castle is a popular tourist site in Ireland, attracting visitors from all over the world to kiss the stone and tour the castle and its gardens. The word Blarney has come to mean clever, flattering, or coaxing talk. Irish politician John O'Connor Power defined it this way. I am not going to speak in an Irish accent, so don't get me into that. But he said, Blarney is something more than mere flattery. It is flattery sweetened by humor and flavored by wit. Those who mix with Irish folk have many examples of it in their everyday experience. Letitia Elizabeth Landon described its contemporary meaning in an article entitled Blarney Castle in 1832. Now, there is origins and talks about it, a ritual of it's the legend behind it. Now, it's in music and literature, but origins is a number of stories attempt to explain the origin of the stone and surrounding legend. Thus, the Blarney Stone is said to impart the ability to deceive without offending, as McCarthy then incorporated it into the parapets of the castle. The proprietors of Blarney Castle list several other explanations of the origins of the stone on their websites. Moreover, an analysis by geologists at the University of Glasgow in 2014 found the stone's geochemical signature matches local limestone. Now, the ritual behind it is that the ritual of kissing the Blarney Stone, according to the castle's proprietors, has been performed by millions of people, including world statesmen, literary giants, and legends of the Silver Screen. Although the parapet is now fitted with wrought iron guide rails and protective crossbars, the ritual can still trigger attacks of acrophobia. Before the safeguards were installed, the kiss was performed with real risk to life and limb as participants were grasped by the ankles and dangled bodily from the height. In the Sherlock Holmes radio dramatization, The Adventure of the Blarney Stone, first broadcast on March 18, 1946, a man attempting to kiss the Blarney Stone falls to his death. Holmes' investigation reveals this as a murder, the man's boots having been super pitiously greased before the attempt. William Henry Hurlburt wrote in 1888 that the legend of the stone seemed to be less than 100 years old at that time, suggesting the tradition began late in the 18th century. The legend of the Blarney Stone was described in Classical Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue by Francis Gross, printed 1785. And so the legend behind this says is claims that the synonymy of Blarney with empty flattery or beguiling talk derives from one of two sources. One story involves the goddess Cladonna and Cormac Laidir McCarthy. Another legend suggests that Queen Elizabeth I requested Cormac MacDiarmid McCarthy, the Lord of Blarney, be deprived of his traditional land rights. I'm gonna go with they're a mix of both, but moving on to Cormac traveled to see the Queen, but was certain he wouldn't persuade her to change her mind as he wasn't an effective speaker. He met an old woman on the way who told him that anyone who kissed a particular stone in Blarney Castle would be given the gift of eloquent speech. Cormac went on to persuade the queen that he should not be deprived of his land. Echoing the supposed power of the stone, an Irish bard of the early 19th century, Francis Sylvester Mahony, added a number of humorous lines to Richard Alfred Millikan's The Groves of Blarney. It says, "Tis theirs the stone that whoever kisses, he never misses to grow eloquent. Tis he may clamber to a lady's chamber, or become a member of parliament. A noble spouter he'll sure turn out, or an outs and outer to be let alone. Don't try to hinder him or to bewilder him, for he is a pilgrim from the Blarney Stone." According to tradition at Texas Tech University, a stone fragment displayed on its campus since 1939 is a missing piece of the Blarney Stone. How this was determined is unknown. I have an idea, which I'm sure we all do. Be that as it may, does it have any kind of spiritual power towards it that would affect people? I'd probably stay away from it because you don't know what it might procure upon you just by kissing it. And especially with a bunch of people that have kissed the stone, I would not do that. That's just disgusting. So, moving on to the next one on the list, we actually have three of them left. We have Body of Light, Boleyn, and Book of Shadows. So, Body of Light. What I wrote down here is a thelemal or thelema term for astral body. But we're gonna go over that real quick, so that way talk to you all about this. And one thing I do gotta mention here. There's a heavy occult connection between Christianity, Islam, and Sumerian belief. Believing in, there are seven heavens. But we're not gonna get onto it with this part. This, probably not this season, maybe next season. But Body of Light, sometimes called the astral body or the subtle body, is a quasi-material aspect of the human body, being neither solely physical nor solely spiritual, posited by a number of philosophers and elaborated on according to various esoteric, occult, and mystical teachings. Other terms used for this body include body of glory, spirit body, luciform body, Agoids, basically means radiant body, astroids, meaning starry or sidereal body, and celestial body. The concept derives from the philosophy of Plato. The word astral means of the stars. Thus, the astral plane consists of the seven heavens of the celestial planets. The idea is rooted in common worldwide religious accounts of the afterlife, in which the soul's journey or ascent is described in such terms as an ecstatic, mystical, or out-of-body experience, wherein the spiritual traveler leaves the physical body and travels in their body of light into higher realms. Neoplatonists Porphyry and Proclus elaborated on Plato's description of the starry nature of the human psyche. Throughout the Renaissance, philosophers and alchemists, healers including Paracelsus and his students, and natural scientists such as John Dee. And by the way, John Dee invented the numerical value 007 as writing to Queen Elizabeth I. So that's where that comes from. And John Dee was not a natural scientist. He was an occultist. Continued to discuss the nature of the astral world intermediate between Earth and the divine. The concept of the astral body or body of light was adopted by 19th century ceremonial magician Alphys Levi, Florence Farr, and the magicians of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, including Aleister Crowley. It does talk about feeler things like Neoplatonism, Renaissance medicine and magic, Isaac Newton, Franz Anton Mesmer, Helena Blavatsky, ceremonial magic that Alphys Levi, Florence Farr, and the Golden Dawn did, as well as Aleister Crowley, other uses, and meditation research. So when we go down to other uses, it says the term body of light is also used in Tibetan Buddhism, particularly in the Dzogchen and Mahamudra traditions. It's the usual translation of the Tibetan term Odlus, also known as the illusory body. So, essentially, it's meaning your soul. It's a different word for saying your soul. Of course, we have Bolin. And Bolin is a white-handled ritual knife for carving candles, an inscription, and cutting herbs, mainly. So it is used for alchemy. That's one of several magical tools that's used in Wicca. And unlike the athame, which is most traditions, is never used for actual physical cutting. The Bolin is used for cutting cords and herbs, carving candles, etc. It has a small, straight, or crescent-shaped blade with traditionally a white handle. So, the Bolin has been adopted, this is its purpose, by several other modern forms of witchcraft, including eclectic witchcraft, or Wicca. Among these later traditions, opinions vary as to whether the Bolin is truly a magical tool or is merely of utilitarian purpose. Similarly, sometimes a white hilted knife called a kerfane, various spellings, is used for roughly the same purposes as the Bolin. According to the kitchen witchcraft philosophy, the use of magical tools for mundane purposes like cooking is actively encouraged, and as such, there is a little or no need for a Bolin as a separate tool from the athame. Some traditions, such as that of Robert Cotran, also describe the use of a single knife for both ritual and practical purposes. In Key of Solomon, many of the Bolins advertised in online magic shops have a characteristic crescent shape and are described as being for harvesting herbs. This crescent shape is reminiscent of the sickle described in the Key of Solomon, a medieval grimoire, and one of the sources of the modern Wicca. Confusingly, an Italian version of the Key of Solomon has a hook-shaped knife called in artao, a possible root for athame, and a straight needle-shaped blade called a bolino. When the name Bolin was first used to describe the crescent-shaped blade, is not clear. In the book Ceremonial Magic, published by Arthur Edward Waite in 1911, Waite references a number of early works on magic, which mention the Bolin or sickle, saying, quote, "Among the necessary properties mentioned by the Book of True Black Magic are the sword, the staff, the rod, the lancet, the architrave, or hook, the Bolin or sickle, the needle, the poniard, a white-handled knife, and another knife, with a black handle, used to describe the circle. The most important to make is that called the Bolin." End quote. So, it is an occult tool used for, again, alchemy purposes. But the last one that we have here on the list, it's called Book of Shadows. This is the last one we're on. And then we are going to end it. So that way we can move on to letter C for the next episode. Book of Shadows, it talks about the history, such as its origins. Valiant's rewriting. Also talks about in British traditional Wicca, contemporary usage, publication, in eclectic Wicca, other traditions, and popular culture. But A Book of Shadows is a book containing religious text and instructions for magical rituals found within the neo-pagan religion of Wicca. Since its conception in the 1970s, it has made its way into many pagan practices and paths. The most famous Book of Shadows was created by the pioneering Wiccan Gerald Gardner sometime in the late 1940s or early 1950s, and which he utilized first in his Bricket Wood Coven and then in other covens which he founded in following decades. The Book of Shadows is also used by other Wiccan traditions, such as Alexandrian Wiccan and Mosinism. And with the rise of books teaching people how to begin following non-initiatory Wicca in the 1970s onward, the idea of the Book of Shadows was then further propagated amongst solitary practitioners unconnected to earlier initiatory traditions. Initially, when Wicca was still dominated by covens, quote, only one copy of the book existed for an entire coven, kept by the high priestess or high priest. The rule has proved unfeasible, and it is now commonplace for all witches to have their own copies, end quote. In the various traditions that make up British traditional Wicca, copies of the original book composed by Gerald Gardner, with the aid of his high priestess, Doreen Valiant, along with alterations and additions that have been made since then, is followed by adherents. Though originally a secret text only given to initiates of Wicca, many initiate and non-initiates alike have gone on to print various books of shadows. These figures include Charles Cardell, Lady Sheba, and Janet, and Stuart Farrar, to name a few. Janet is just a British teacher and author in neo-paganism books on Wicca and neo-paganism. In other Wiccan traditions and amongst a number of solitary practitioners, alternate versions of the Book of Shadows have been written which are independent of Gardner's original. Numerous associations and traditions have since grown up around the Book of Shadows. Traditionally, a witch's Book of Shadows is destroyed upon death. It can be an experimental practice, everyday ritual works, or a record of magic. This is also a book of inspiration and can be used in future rituals. The concept of the Book of Shadows has subsequently appeared in popular culture. For instance, being used in the American television series Charmed, which popularized the Book of Shadows. So, origins to the Book of Shadows talks about coming from Gerald Gardner. So, Gerald Gardner was a more recent than anything else individual. So, how it came before that? Probably passed down throughout the centuries by the occult world. But besides it having a rewriting that in British traditional Wicca also has contemporary usage, such as there sometimes exists two books of shadows kept by more traditional Wiccans, one being a coven book of core rituals and practices which remains unchanged and from which new initiates copy, and the second intended for personal use. which differs from witch to witch and contains magical material collected by the initiate, such as astrology, herbal lore, and information regarding divination. And of course, an eclectic Wicca. In non-traditional or eclectic forms of Wiccan or neo-pagan practices or practice, the term Book of Shadows is more often used to describe a personal journal rather than a traditional text. The journal records rituals, spells, and their results, as well as other magical information. This can be either an individual or covenant text, and is not normally passed from teacher to student. In many cases, this kind of Book of Shadows is an electronic document, disc, or website instead of a handwritten one. Some reserve the Book of Shadows for recording spells and keep a separate book, sometimes called the Book of Mirrors, to contain thoughts, feelings, and experiences. And of course, we have it in popular culture. Talks about it as well. So, now that we have gotten through list B, we have list C. And so, while the first one I have on my list is cartomancy, first one that's here on the actual list is candle. And what a candle can be used for so many different things, so I don't think I'll just go into candle, but I might do it. We'll see. So, you all have been awesome listening to this content, especially those that have listened from the beginning. And I appreciate you all that if you're able to donate, you can do so with my Cash App. If not, no worries. The best way you can help out is by sharing this podcast. We'll get more people to help support this. So until next time, I'll see you all. Peace.